I hope that a lot more people read this collection in particular, because I think that even for some of its flaws, it's always having very important and very interesting conversations.
To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show, Reading Rangers today. I'm Trishy Mattson.
I'm Brandon O'Brien.
And I'm Daniel Hauser.
And today we are discussing an anthology of solarpunk stories called Solarpunk: Ecological and Fantastical Stories in a Sustainable World, edited by Gerson Lodi Ribeiro and translated by Fabio Fernandez. So, anyone want to start off with their general thoughts about the anthology?
I definitely do.
Okay.
So, I'm really into solarpunk. I think a lot of very particular communities are very, very good at understanding solarpunk on personal, kind of national and regional level. And I think Brazil, being part of Latin America, has this kind of understanding about not only their own place in the green energy conversation, because they've made so much real world strides towards being more renewable and being more energy conscious in that sense, but also very conscious of the fact that the world doesn't get better because you have those things, that corruption and crime and violence and stuff like that will still be a part of your national conversation even though you get this one thing right. And I think so many of these stories are very, very good at acknowledging, yes, we have all of these fantastic solarpunk and even biopunk moments of progress in these worlds that these writers have created. But politicians are still corrupt, people still kill people, biases and discrimination still exists. Like, the fact that it's still very conscious and critical on that sense, instead of simply writing beautiful, hopeful stories that we would have typically expected from solarpunk, is particularly refreshing to me, because it says that writers in Latin America as a region, and in particular Brazil, are having conversations about how, even when you get some of those things right, it leads to some trickle down in terms of how politics society still engages.
Daniel, do you have any general thoughts before we dive into the stories?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Brandon said. Personally, I was completely new to this subgenre when it was first being discussed as something that we talk about on Skiffy and Fanny. I looked into it, and I kind of got excited about it. As a biologist, I wanted to see what people were writing in terms of speculation of what the ecology could hold for the future. And on my campus now, I'm actually involved in this sustainability initiative that faculty and staff have been trying to do in conjunction with administration to move the campus towards a sustainable future in terms of our imprint on the planet and our environment. And what we found really early on was that everybody has a different definition of what sustainability is. And I kind of got that sense from this collection as well, that sort of what Brandon was saying, that societies might be able to respond to certain crises and make things work, but at the same time, that often comes at the cost of something else. So in here, a lot of the stories were advances that were made in terms of creating sustainable energy now led to damages and an exploitation of humans in some way that made human life actually less sustainable, despite having energy being more sustainable, for example. And that was in contrast to some of the stories. I read another collection of solar punk that was called Sun Vault, Stories of Solar Punk and Eco-Speculation. And some of the stories in there seemed very utopic to me and really filled with that hope. But they ended up kind of ringing hollow to me because they lacked sort of a believability that this would just be able to be easily solved. And what I liked about this collection on the whole was that you did get that sense that there wasn't going to be an easy solution, that even if something becomes solved, there are going to be consequences within a society.
I actually really want to kind of piggyback on something that Daniel said, specifically as someone who is, like, full disclosure, I have poetry in Sun Vault. I really like Sun Vault. I really like all of the work that's in it. So I don't want any of this conversation to seem like the contrast is kind of bashing them.
No.
But I do agree with you that there is a kind of distinction between the overwhelming utopianism of Sun Vault and the conversations that this work has. And I really feel like emphasizing the fact that I do think that that's a cultural acknowledgement, that because there is a certain kind of wastefulness when it comes to human resources in Brazil, in terms of discrimination, in terms of violence, in terms of government corruption, stuff like that, as it is in most other places in Latin America, unfortunately. All of these stories kind of came specifically to that thing that you pointed out, that when energy resources are in this beautiful surplus because of all the technological advances that have been made, cruel people will go to any lengths to make sure that they can continue exploiting human resources as badly as possible. Like, deliberately go out of their way to be cruel in some instances.
Yeah, I think it's an important lesson in some of this fiction and some others that we've read, or that I've read, is that scarcity is not the root of all evil. That, you know, even when people have enough to survive on, you know, that does not mean that everything is going to be great among people, because human nature includes selfishness and arrogance and other problems. I found this collection interesting, but not a lot of the stories resonated with me very much. That's probably partly because I may not be the target audience for this collection, but not so much that, but that, you know, I felt like I may have been missing out on references during stories. There may be, you know, historical echoes or things about politics now that would carry into the future that I just don't have a handle on. So although I was, you know, reading the stories, the words that were there, I felt like sometimes I must have been missing out on words that weren't there, that were, you know, in the subtext. But, you know, that's on me, and the way to cure that is to read more widely in the field. You know, plenty of room for lots more anthologies besides Sun Vault and Solar Punk, and hopefully this is the beginning of my explorations in the field. Hopefully I'll get better on that. But do y'all want to start, go through stories one by one, or would everyone like to, you know, pick a favorite or two and talk about them, or what?
There is one particular story that I do have a lot of feelings about because it is my favorite. And interestingly enough, it is the very first story. Silent Green is People by Carlos Orsi. I will get literally the only nitpick that I have about the story out of the way, which is, why this title? Like, I know what was trying to be evoked and stuff like that, so I'm not going to complain too much about it. But the rundown of the story is that an unnamed detective is hired by a very strange Orthodox church to discover the whereabouts of a disabled woman who may or may not have passed away after news breaks that her son has committed suicide, and the process by which he investigates that man's work as a bioengineer and the relationship that he had with his fiance and his mother lead to perhaps one of the most satisfying twists in a mystery story that I've ever seen it read before. But part of the reason why I was so drawn to this story is specifically because it's a very hard-boiled-esque story. The detective hero of the story is never named. He just goes about and does stuff and is badass on a regular basis. It plays out almost exactly like a Dashiell Hammett or a Raymond Chandler would, just with these additions of the bioengineering understanding of the story and this weird description of this very cultish but otherwise descriptively orthodox, not very distinct from Christianity religion that dominates the way that people think about their bodies. All of those things just kind of came together in a way where I feel like this is the kind of story that if you showed it to anybody who wasn't familiar with solarpunk as a genre, or even arguably if they weren't familiar with mysteries as a genre, they would still get something out of it. But as I said, the ending of the story was, I thought it was going in one place and then it went in two places at once. And I was really, really, like, fascinated in particular that by the fact that even though the solarpunk bioengineering element of the story was the means for a crime that was committed, it wasn't the motive for anybody involved. And it was really just two very human conflicts that led to this confluence of crime taking place in this story, and I thought that that was particularly interesting that Orsi decided not to go for the easy route of somebody did this for out of greed or out of trying to take control of a thing, but because of very human emotional strivings between everybody involved.
Yeah, this was one of the stories, I don't know if it was my favorite in the collection, but it's one of the ones I really enjoyed a lot, and I thought it was a great start to the collection as a whole to kind of draw the reader into to what is contained here. And I adored the mashup of, or the combination of genres that were here, the mystery with the speculation, because both of them, as you said, were just handled so well. And not necessarily in the route that you would be expecting as you're reading it. And that ending and that overall feel of it kind of went along with some of the science or the information that was in it that I also found really interesting, the story in terms of nitrogen cycling and discussions of like using nitrates in fertilizers and the impact that those have had on the environment. That's something that was developed through artificial means to be able to increase agricultural production, to have a benefit for humanity, to be able to feed more people so that people wouldn't starve, and we could grow things more cheaply. But the consequence of that was that it led to nitrate pollution so that it disrupted the balance of organisms in freshwater or marine environments and leads to species die-offs, and it creates all these problems that now came as a result of people's good intentions of trying to solve the issue of hunger. And so that the way that the science and the backstory kind of fit in with this new way of taking things as well and the speculation, I thought was just brilliant.
Okay. So, Daniel, do you want to take the next story sequentially, or is there a favorite of yours from the collection that you'd like to?
I guess I'll kind of summarize overall, maybe, if that's okay.
Sure.
The first three, there's a total of 9 stories in there. And the first three overall I really liked a lot because of like the concepts and particularly the biology behind it. And the next two, When Kingdoms Collide, is one of the ones that features this concept of people getting energy through photosynthesis and consequences of that of creating new types of people. I don't know as I like the execution of those concepts necessarily in all of them, but those first stories, I really loved the background ideas of them at the very least. And then the final three stories in the collection, I really adore too, for sometimes different reasons. Particularly two of the highlights for me that it wasn't the concept or the science behind that I was really enamored with, but I just thought they were wonderful stories and really cool universes that I wanted to see more of were Zubaba Dreams of the West by Andre Silva, and the final one, Cobalt Blue and the Enigma by Gerson Louis Ribeiro, the overall editor of this collection. And those two, the last one was just a very, I found it a very exciting kind of adventure kind of story that kept me on the edge of my seat as I was reading it. And so I thought it was a lot of fun to read that one. And then the Zubaba Dreams of the West, I particularly liked because of the alternate universe that it was set in, where the West hadn't really come into the New World to colonize, and so things took a different route, yet it still ended up with forms of slavery, it still ended up with people being oppressed, just in a different way now. And so the world of that story I just found kind of fascinating. And that surprised me, because that type of story, the alternate history kind of story, is not really my thing that I usually go for a lot of times. But I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I would say that Zubaba Dreams of the West was probably my favorite story in the collection. It was, as you say, the world building was really interesting. And I got the feeling that if I had maybe read it in the original, there might have been more poetry in, or, you know, not poetry, not rhymes, but more loving use of words. Here, you know, I felt like I was getting echoes of what was probably beautiful writing. It was good writing. Don't get me wrong. It was still there were, you know, phrases that struck me, but I felt I just had the hint of a suspicion that I was missing out on something. But so it goes.
One of the things that I was trying to think about consciously, even though I don't speak Portuguese, is the fact that this is a translation of a work. And when I got to Zubaba Dreams of the West, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, I also had the same thought that Trish did, that this, in its native Portuguese, is probably exploring all these beautiful turns of phrase, and everything is falling together in the mind in a certain kind of flow that echoes the tone and the style of the story. But one of the things that I appreciated about it as a story was that it took this opportunity to do this regularly frequented thing that former colonized countries tend to do in their fiction, of trying to imagine a world where the effects of colonization didn't actually affect them, and use that as an opportunity to still hit on what is the underlying theme of the collection at this point, which is sometimes people just do terrible things anyway, and sometimes the circumstances that we aren't, sometimes even when you change the circumstances of history or of the future, there is still a kind of disadvantage that comes upon humans specifically because of the circumstances that you're now in.
Right, and eliminating one oppressor may simply mean that you get a different oppressor instead.
In terms of the translation, I'll agree that it comes and goes in terms of, I don't know about the quality, but I think some of them more easily lend to translation than others. And so you notice some don't quite flow quite as naturally as I'm sure they do in the native Portuguese. But I think it's important to also note that what Fabio Fernandez had to do here is not an easy task, because these stories are very different.
Oh, yes.
From one another in the language. And so it must be an enormous challenge to try to translate, even in the same language, things that are just so different from one another, because it's not just one work, it's nine different works that you're dealing with here.
Yes, I didn't mean that at all as a knock against the translator.
No.
It's just that, you know, sometimes the richness of one language is really hard to express in another language.
Definitely.
Yeah. And especially echoing your point of the fact that they're such diverse stories is that I think a lot of the writers were genuinely being experimental in their approach to the story and storytelling in general.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other stories that I wouldn't say that it was necessarily one of my favorites, but stuck with me specifically because of that is Breaking News by Romeo Martins.
Yes.
Which I really, really adored for its transcript style in the majority of the story, but fell apart in terms of prose by the time it came to its epilogue. And I suspected that that was also because of the challenge of translation, that when you, that in its native Portuguese, perhaps Martins was trying to be very ornate or very deliberate about his word choices in a way that just naturally didn't lend itself to just being dryly reported in the form that it takes. Whereas just the fact that it opens with this transcript of a news report automatically got my attention because I was like, something is happening. You're trying to tell me that something important is happening here simply using this format. And I'm already tuned into trying to understand what that is. And it makes the genuinely very interesting reveal at the end of the story that this was all a ploy, that this is how organizations typically take advantage of the way that news is reported in order to achieve their own ends. It made it kind of fall flat compared to the actual report of the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that story, I believe that it was stylized basically the way that the writer meant it to be. It felt very much like it was supposed to be kind of that old-fashioned sort of science fictional writing with the transcripts and all the monologuing that a certain individual, Orson Wellman, I believe the scientist's name was.
yes.
I'm sure that that style was deliberate. It didn't appeal to me as much as it did to you, but, I mean, the monologuing did get a bit long, but I'm pretty sure that that one came across basically the way it was meant to in the original language. That's just how it felt to me. You know, I'm not speaking of knowledge because I do not speak Portuguese.
Yeah, for me, that the style of that one, it really hit with me, and so that on a positive way. So the combination of that style and the genetic engineering concepts, and then also the overall sociological commentary on organizations both using the technology and the science, but also news media. That overall, that was a success for me, but I can easily see how others might not appreciate that as much. It was actually the one that followed it that I'm curious if anybody else had thoughts on, because out of all of them, I think this is the one that I'm most... I don't remember much of, other than it seemed dense and very hard for me to really to figure out what the author was going for, and that's the Once Upon a Time in the World.
I think I had the same problem that you did. Like, immediately I had this kind of... I try not to like make people feel bad about the stumbling block that I have when it comes to reading a lot of science fiction in particular. But when I feel like I'm being surrounded by information, when I'm like learning the names of things still and trying to put them in context, it becomes difficult for me to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. And there are so many names in just the first portion of this story. So many things to put in the context that the author is trying to put them in. And I felt like there was very strong, deliberate world building that was supposed to be taking place that was going over my head because of that disengagement that I was having solely in my head. Like, I understand that it's my fault. I understand that it was happening in my head, but it still got in the way of engaging fully.
I'm afraid that story didn't engage me at all. It had just one line, one good line in it that struck me was, "You're under arrest in the name of the future." which I enjoyed the idea of that and how it was said, but overall, that story didn't do much for me. One story that I did feel a lot of emotion about was one of your favorite last three, Daniel, and that was Sun in the Heart.
Yeah.
And that was it was from the viewpoint of a father and his wife, and their son was getting ready for the initial nanogenetic tattoo, which was going to make him able to harvest sun energy. And the father had a lot of mixed feelings about it, and the mother was philosophically and from her life experiences coming from a very different place than he was. And I really liked how they went into how the different experiences shaped their perceptions and thoughts about what was happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one was probably, I think that was the most emotional one out of the collection for me. There were lots that I enjoyed in terms of the science, in terms of the overall story, or the plot, or the action. But that was the most moving, I thought, in the collection. Also from the point of view of just ideas of disparity between people that are able to have this tattoo versus those that aren't. There were a lot of connections in my mind that ran from teaching about vaccinations all the time in microbiology, about people's skepticism of getting a vaccine, of what might happen, or is this something that's going to be safe? Is this something I want to give to my child, or is it not? Those thoughts kept running through my mind as I was reading it, and so I enjoyed the story for that.
That's a very interesting observation that didn't dawn on me when I experienced this story. Part of the reason why I enjoyed this story, perhaps not as much as the both of you did, but I still enjoyed the fact that it was placed in the point in the anthology where it was, because it felt, for the most part, that the anthology was trying to come down from very heady conversations about the government and society and power into a conversation that still associates itself with conversations of power, but through the lens of people interacting with each other and actually having a relationship with each other. I feel like a lot of stories didn't have a great opportunity for that. Like, one of the downsides that I found in When Kingdoms Collide is that I didn't have any attachment to the romantic relationship that was a part of that story, because it felt like it wasn't really there. But there are emotional relationships in Sun in the Heart that, even if you don't really thoroughly engage with the story as it is, you can still engage with the fact that these are characters that feel like real people who feel like they're in a real relationship.
Yes. Let's see. So there are a few more stories in the collection that we haven't really touched on yet. One of them, Gary Johnson. That was another one that felt deliberately old-fashioned. It felt like the story was aiming for a style akin to some of the old Lovecraft stories or some of the early Robert Howard that I've read. Basically, you start out, you know, there's lots of stuff from a journal and references to letters and things that happened hundreds of years ago, or, you know, okay, not hundreds of years ago, but decades ago. But I rather enjoyed it. It is not a, well, I was going to say it's not a personal story, but it does talk about, you know, someone's personal anguish and guilt in it. But it's much more the old, you know, mad science experiments, and combined with the relationship between science and religion, and combined with racism that is, of course, pointed out to be such, but one of the characters feels that that's justified, and feels that it's justified to harvest soul energy from certain people. And so it wasn't a story that moved me, but I found it interesting to see how it was interrogating some old stereotypes of the kind of pulp fiction that you might have read back in the 20s and 30s.
That's interesting, because that might be a case where, because I'm not as familiar with that sort of older pulp fiction. And even Lovecraft, when I read a Lovecraftian tale now, it kind of escapes me because I've never read actual Lovecraft. And that's one of those cases where I like this story, but it didn't connect with me hugely. And I think that's probably because I was missing a lot of those references. And it felt out of place to me because I wasn't quite getting how it fit in the larger context.
Mm-hmm.
It also, the length of it, at a certain point, I began to tire of it.
Sure.
And that's, I'm not blaming the author for that. It's me, I know. There's certain kinds of stories, if they're not connecting, I have a more difficult time with them if they're on the longer side of a short story compared to, you know, very short.
Well, the author did choose a very slow wind-up to what could have been a shorter story told more compactly, but that was a stylistic choice, I think.
That's the mood, yeah, mm-hmm. Which makes sense to me now, but at the time of reading it, I didn't make that connection, I don't think.
I had a lot of the same difficulties in engaging. I tried my very best because, like, there were, like, little bits of things that I thought were particularly interesting. In particular, I think it was kind of fascinating to have that conversation not only between science and religion from the context of the story in particular, but I feel like in a Brazilian cultural context, that sounds like it's supposed to be a very interesting and very strongly played dichotomy. But the way that language is played in this story made it really hard for me to care. And in particular, there are a lot of I's and me's in this story, but you never actually connect with the persona writing the story, because the story cares about all of these other characters. And it was kind of disconnecting for me personally, because I felt like I was supposed to get something of the persona and what they thought about what was taking place, and I felt like I didn't get enough of that. I felt like they were just reporting things. It felt like someone writing a Wikipedia entry on a family member and not actually engaging with their feelings about the things that they had experienced. I don't know, it felt kind of weird for me.
It's fine. We all have different feelings and thoughts about all these stories. It's fun to hear the perspectives from other people, though.
Mm-hmm. And that's what happens when you have these. That's what I love about anthologies,
mm-hmm.
is that you get these very varied types of stories. And on the one hand, it can, even if you don't connect to something, reading an anthology the first time through, there's things I've read years ago that at the time I just didn't get, but they introduced me to it at least. And so when I come into contact with a story that's similar or in a vein like that in the future, I've had that exposure where now I'm able to meet it at a different place. And so that's one of the things I really like about anthologies, and I think this is a great example of one that can do that because of the variation there is.
Right. All right, so we haven't talked much about the story Escape. That was a story about a resistance person trying to smuggle some data, and I liked it, but I felt like it felt more like the prologue to another story than a great story in itself.
I would say pretty much the same thing. It was a very strange kind of story for me, in terms of it felt like it was too short to do all of the things that I thought it could have benefited from doing or was necessarily trying to do, but also too long for the things that it did. And it made me feel like there was really a novella here that I would have really probably liked to read a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could have used a little more fleshing out, maybe.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, I agree. In a lot of ways, this one, in my mind, ends up getting compared to the final story of The Cobalt Blue and the Enigma. You have this story that is built largely on action and space opera type themes. And the latter, Cobalt Blue and the Enigma, for me worked because it was given that length to fully develop. It incorporated some ideas in terms of eco-speculation in there. It had sort of like this alternate history vibe to it and interesting world building within it. Escape was much more contained, and as a result, the action that was in there was good for an action story, but ended up being more forgettable to me because it never became anything more than just, as you said, seemed like a part of something else, like a prologue to another story. So in my mind, those two ended up getting compared against one another, fairly or unfairly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a story doesn't have to be long to be good, but just in this case, it needed It needed to feel like there was stuff going on behind the scenes that you didn't see, or it was a little too self-contained. That's how I feel. Someone else may enjoy it more.
I think in some ways it's when you have a self-contained story like that, where you're not bringing in the bigger world, kind of what's going on in the universe at large, that self-contained story, for me at least, really needs to then have some emotional resonance, something very sort of touching, moving in it. It can't just be simple action. And so I think that's where it faltered for me in that regard, is that by leaving out the sort of bigger picture to the universe in terms of the action and what the implications were, and making it a very personal story, that personal story was lacking connection to the character.
Yes, I didn't really get a strong sense of why she was a rebel, why she felt it was valuable to give her life in service of this cause.
Especially considering that this story spends a lot of time giving descriptions of momentary glimpses of the world that the character is in. I feel like there would have been room for that if it were just a little bigger. Like, I feel like this story was trying to be a thing and ran out of words to fit. Because I feel like there were moments where this story was trying to give us that and didn't, in favor of continuing the action so they could close the action in time. Like, I really do want to see what this story would have... Like, it's a kind of annoying thing. I wanted to see what this story would have been if it were the story that it was trying to be.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, we've talked at least briefly about all of the stories in the collection. So, any final thoughts from either of you? Or any points you feel like we still need to touch on?
I mean, the only thought that I really have is, I guess, a kind of context one. I'm really glad that this anthology exists. Like, the general science fiction and fantasy community is only, like, as far as I've seen at least, recently kind of embraced or re-embraced what solarpunk can do in terms of conversations about how we can be more conscious and more critical, not only of our relationship to energy, but our relationship to power. And I think it's particularly valuable that this collection from Brazil is one of the more interesting and more valuable collections in that regard that I've seen. I hope that a lot more people read this collection in particular, because I think that even for some of its flaws, it's always having very important and very interesting conversations. And I want to see what more stuff like this will look like as we keep exploring it, and keep exploring it from the multiple sort of disparate lenses on the continuum between Sun Vault on the very utopian end and solarpunk on the nearly dystopian end and the socio-politically critical end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sort of drawing right from that, now having read both this collection, the Solarpunk, and then also having previously read Sun Vault, and as an aside, Elizabeth Fitzgerald from Skiffing Fanny, she's also reviewed Sun Vault, and so people can find her review and comments on that, and I encourage people to check that out. I liked both Sunvault and I liked Solarpunk, large amounts of them, but for very different reasons. And I think that gets to that they're approaching them from different points of view. There's some overlap, of course, but they're both anthologies or collections that give a very good entry point, I guess, into this idea of Solarpunk. And there's another collection out there called Glass and Gardens, Solarpunk Summers, that Serena Ulibarri was involved with. And she also wrote the foreword, if I remember correctly, to this Solarpunk one that we just talked about. And so I haven't read that one yet, but I'm looking forward to finding that. But in the introduction to this one, I found it interesting, and I wasn't aware of just how much Brazil has done in terms of making decisions or policies towards more sustainable energy or develop technologies for that. And now I read in the newspaper, after recent elections, a very right-wing government has been elected there. And a lot of the things that Brazil seemed to have been doing is now being rescinded by the new government that is coming to power. And so it kind of goes along with the sort of bittersweet, there's some hope for the future, but at the same time, it's a constant battle that reality and this collection, I think, call to mind that it's not going to be a pure march forward to betterment. There's going to be some back steps, and it's always going to be a fight to do what's right.
Right. Those are some really interesting thoughts from both of you. I am happy that I read this collection. I hope to read more in the Solar Punk and maybe Solar Hope or Hope Punk or whatever it is. I like the range of possibilities between dystopias and utopias, and I certainly will be looking for more stories along these lines. I love the title of the Glass and Gardens anthology that you mentioned, Daniel. Yeah, so I'm very happy that we ended up reading and reviewing this collection, and I'll definitely be looking for more stuff along these lines to read. And so, I'm not sure what we're going to be reading next for Reading Rangers Shorts, but I'm very sure that it'll be interesting. There's so much good fiction out there.
So much.
So very, very much.
I can never keep up.
It's impossible, but that's why I just keep trying to sample different kinds.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, I guess that just about wraps up our conversation. I'd like to thank each of you for your thoughts, sharing your thoughts today. I thought that was a pretty good conversation.
Yeah, thank you both.
And thanks to Jen for editing this, and thank you to our listeners. If you'd like to continue the conversation with us, we are on Twitter at Skiffy and Fanty, and there are many other ways to reach us. So look us up and let us know what you think if you've read any of these stories or any other solar punk that you'd like to recommend.
Yes, please.
All right, thanks everybody.
Awkward ending.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.